We have Professor Stewart back with us again to continue his series exploring the peers of Bengal. And Professor Stewart has already spoken to us at great length, coming from Vanderbilt University. We're happy to have him here both last term and this. And today, happily, he'll be speaking about mapping the Bengali imaginaire, the Bombibi Johoranama, and the conditions of possibility for peer katha. Over to you.
Great, thank you very much. I've been flat on my back all week, so I'm feeling a little slow here, but hopefully that won't affect much. As a starting point to better understand the work of the narratives of the fictive peers, which I've been boring you with for the last several months, we accepted Todorov's and Macheri's argument that the worlds constructed by those stories are completely self-contained. This remove exempts their tales from evaluation according to the discourses of everyday reality, that is, from the world of truth or falsity. The worlds they depict are indeed self-contained, and thereby legislate for themselves all that one needs to know to apprehend the story being told. And of necessity, those worlds so constructed are always incomplete. Fictional worlds are neither incomprehensible, nor are they completely alien to the humans who produce them, even though they are autotelic. They are furnished with the landscapes, in this case of Bengal and the Sundarbans, the basic structure of the cosmos, heavens, earth, and other configurations, the types of characters such as fakirs, bibis, jogis, knots, padres, and so forth. So the stories are made comprehensible precisely because of their context, their framing, which is generated by the people who compose them. Those authors are very real. They live in a Bangla-speaking world. The Bangla texts they write and circulate are very real, and they had to have been something in their historical situation that stimulated them to generate those domains. The content of the narrative that is mind-produced defines its own reality, and that reality need not automatically conform to the world of ordinary things, though it does depend on that world for comprehension. That's an important distinction. Its meanderings and explorations, which are often subjunctive, allow the reader or listener momentarily to escape the discursive strictures of history, theology, and law found in mainstream Musulmani society. Yet it is against that backdrop that they were generated. They open a space that is not regulated in the ways of those discourses, a subjunctive space. But that space does, in fact, have strictures. The seeming impasse created by granting the autotelic quality of the narratives, and for those of you, if you didn't hear earlier, autotelic refers to completely self-contained worlds that are in these fictions, that would remove them from the real life of religious legislation, is in part a function of their ontology. That is, the characterizations about their reality is actually an attempt to address their status vis-a-vis that of things in the ordinary world. The narratives as fictions stand quite apart as language-dependent and language-mediated realities, a product that takes its reality purely from discourse. In evaluating the reality of fictions, epistemologist Nicholas Rescher observes that, quote, discourse alone underwrites no workable distinction between fact and fiction. Rather, context is required, which is a standard of measure that lies outside of discourse. And further, I quote, as far as the discourse itself is concerned, a statement's fictionality, like its truth or falsity, is altogether invisible. It is something that cannot be extracted from the statement itself and generally requires us to look beyond discourse as such. As a result, fictions create trouble for theorists because the fiction's internal truth does not correspond with factu cor, but rather pivots on an oblique story-mediated correspondence with fact. And I quote Rescher again, neither I nor anyone else can offer an example of a possible world for which there is not a real-world author, a living, breathing producer who conjures up some possibility by a coup d'esprit. All of the possible worlds at our disposal are fictional constructs arising from the suppositional thought work of the living, breathing individuals who project them by way of imagination. Accordingly, the question of the ontology of possible worlds does not call for transcendental metaphysics, but for a deflationary account that sees such worlds as thought artifacts produced by and only available through the mental operations of real-world individuals by means of supposition, assumption, hypothesis or the like. Now, he goes on to point out that there are, strictly speaking, no fictional fictions. There are no fictions unless real people really make them up, which is another way of saying that these texts and their stories do not come into existence ex nihilo. Rather, they have context, linguistic, literary, religious, ethnic, geographic, historical. Those together somehow give them shape. The creators of the tales are constrained by these various contexts, which means that the tales themselves are not produced indiscriminately. There are limitations on what they can imagine, historically grounded limitations that are both restricting and enabling. These limitations define the discursive parameters of the imaginaire, which is the realm within which the imagination operates. I will define the discursive arena of any text as the realm of the imaginaire, a term which should not be confused with the imagination, particularly Sartre's use of imaginaire, and which he says is a psychological condition or state, nor with the imaginary, following Taylor and others. Rather, I'm using the term the imaginaire as the space where the imagination is exercised, where imaginative activity takes place. As a locus of human thought, the imaginaire is itself structured. It is always historically grounded to particular times and places, and as a result has observable restrictions and an observable conceptual perimeter. The imaginaire defines the realms of possibility for any speaker or actor, one of the most compelling limitations being that of language. It's now widely accepted that the general propositions of the choice of language inevitably structure thought, but historical context likewise dictates other structures of authority that place limits on what can be imagined. So it is curbed by accepted practices and the definers of various modes of discourse, whether in social and legal systems, science, theology, or simply what's often termed common sense. These constraints should not be seen as limiting, but actually enabling, for they provide frameworks within which the imagination can be exercised and which define the boundaries against which the imagination can push and expand, allowing people to think new thoughts. It's seldom possible to envision a world that runs completely counter to prevailing forms. Changes can be wrought, but the structuring itself is seldom, if ever, outside of these constraints. If anybody has an example of this, I'd love to hear about it. Now, this is not to propose some new form of intellectual history, but rather these are pragmatic considerations to help us control our understanding of these processes of creativity inevitably produced by authors in conversation with others at the time and before. In a sense, we're talking about the double voice of Bakhtin's dialogic process as authors and actors give voice to their perspectives, their conceptual worlds in connection to their consumers. It situates the narrative in its fictional world, while the author's own position straddles the divide, one foot in the ordinary world of things and the other in the narrative. But the causality and intentionality of the author as divine from the narrative, however, is elusive at best, and any one-for-one correspondence between an author and his or her fictions is automatically conjecture. But if the fictions are suspended in this realm of the imaginaire, and though that suspension connect and through that suspension connect to the world of the author and of ordinary things, as they especially must do as parodies, which one of my talks was on how these texts function as parody. How do we map in consistent ways the nature of that suspension? The answer inches us closer to answering what kind of cultural work these texts have been performing for their consumers. Now, a number of years ago, while mining bibliographic entries for intertextuality, I came across a small article by Jonathan Culler titled Presupposition and Intertextuality, in which he articulated a generalizable set of propositions that would help situate any literary form. Upon reflection, I've come to realize that these propositions actually apply much more broadly to virtually any configuration of cultural production across discourses that we might approach as a text, from law and the judiciary to architecture, religious ritual, theology, philosophy, and so forth. Kohler's observations are not proposed as the basis of a system of interpretation, but rather isolate four features that any hermeneutic exercise should or could productively analyze to place texts into an imaginal landscape, in that process producing their intellectual or even cultural history. As we've observed, the fictional texts dedicated to the peers do not come into existence in a void, though their provenance may often prove fugitive. These four factors will help define the conditions that allow for the production of any text, and can then, once isolated, guide its understanding. The two forms of proposition are logical and pragmatic, and the two forms of intertextuality, as he outlines them, are explicit or overt and implied, covert. These factors define a text's generative context, its historical conversation partners, and its implied audience, who are in turn invited to understand the text according to its own standards of production and consumption. It's through this exegesis that we can fruitfully address the relationships of the seemingly disparate texts of the Pirkata across centuries. Presuppositions. Every discursive arena is governed by a set of logical presuppositions, that is, rules for conducting discourse. These include such things as what constitutes a rational argument, how to draw a proper inference, or what is allowable as a fact or proof. So the formal nature of logic, such as the mathematical basis of the syllogism, would be included here. It also includes other sources of authority, such as legal rules, and the imaginaire is the realm within which the adjudication of these rules takes place. And as will become apparent, no single standard ultimately prevails in any community, regardless of sectarian or social orientation. Because the logical rules of discourse and their context were not uniform, language users constantly negotiated among them, often defining and redefining the same terminologies. Cosmology is inevitably at the root of logical presupposition, and vice versa, which means that all theological propositions fall under this heading. So too, such propositions as the laws of physics, moral cause and effect, for instance, karma, which is prevalent throughout these Mushalmani productions, and the same for science, mathematics, legal codes, and related bureaucratic and institutional regulations, regardless of provenance. Every discourse takes certain identifiable shapes by assuming certain structures, then, that Kohler labels pragmatic presuppositions. The first obvious but often overlooked pragmatic issue is language. That the stories of the peers and bibis were composed and circulated in the vernacular Bangla, in fact, Mushalmani Bangla, a very specialized form, declares a particular audience that lies outside the discourses of law and theology, which operated primarily through Persian and Arabic or among Hindu populations through Sanskrit. Further, genre is not limited to the outward literary form, but can also be formulated diegetically within the tales themselves, such as different modes of discourse evident within a single tale, the same figure, for instance, as a merchant, a peer, a king, and so forth. The choice of genre, or the switching of diegetic frames of authority within the narratives, regardless of genre, signals authorial perspectives which reflect historical expectations of discursive negotiation. In other words, the choice of form conditions expectations and audiences as much as when the genre for delivery is chosen. Intertextuality. Every text, with its incipient version of like-minded consuming community, inevitably invokes precursor texts, both literally and figuratively, as one allows text to be more broadly understood as any prior source of recognizable authority. These precursors signal an overt intertextuality, an invocation that provides a context for the current story without having to spell it out. In practice, the naming of another text camouflages the vagueness of detailed content, leaving the audience with a sense of knowing more than what is actually stated, allowing them to fill in the blanks according to their own understanding of the applicability of that textual content to the current narrative. Overt intertextuality also serves to obviate, or at least lessen, the need to justify claims through other means. Just by invoking the precursor, its power and prestige are directly associated, if not immediately connected, to the present. There are obvious explicitly cited texts in these tales, such as the Arabic Quran, the Sanskrit Bhagavad Purana. And in many of the tales, it appears in Bibis whose authority is invoked to shore up the position of various characters, to signal affiliation, or even to eliminate dissent by placing the narrative situation in the larger context of prior cultural constructs. We'll see this an example in a few minutes. The explicit invocation of a text clearly aligns an overtly religious text with tradition. But in a literary text, the invocation points to a more general orientation that acknowledges but does not necessarily promote an explicit perspective on cosmological or other religious issues, that is, a religious agenda. Rather, it works through a rhetoric of association that often hinges on analogy of form. For instance, as some of you may recall from an earlier talk, in the opening section of the Manikpir Juhurnama, the hero's father, Badarpir, was married to the princess Dudbibi, and the Quran is brought out and used just like the Brahmin astrologer's text. The two forms are considered equivalent in their efficacy, but the difference in technique and content is not at all at issue for the receiver of the text. It's simply the invocation of the text and its presence that give meaning. When these texts parody, and as I've previously argued they often do, they're parodying other texts, parody being an intramural form of intertextuality. And here I follow Barbara Hutchins' a theory of parody. They are mimetic of the form of prior text and critical, at least in part, of the content of those prior texts. That mimesis, however, has a double effect, for while it functions to relate the text to its precursor, or pretext, it also preserves the precursor's place in the world of the imaginaire. So when you invoke the text, it continues to keep it present. Mimicry, whether positive or negative, ensures the stability of the newly created work, for it anchors itself in what's preceded, and its own effectiveness depends heavily on the precursor. There are also precursors, for instance, a fictional character, for other types of precursors, for instance, a fictional character from one story may suddenly intrude into another, or a historical character may show up in a fictional episode, changing the narrative by their appearance. The names of famous kings, for instance, are often deployed in this technique. Both of these types of appearances, often depicted as but not limited to flashbacks, are labeled analepsis. As a rhetorical strategy, direct or overt intertextuality then stretches to include texts, people, events, and social and political structures, each one lending an authority that resists question. Finally, a significant amount of the discourse defining the world of these early modern narratives hinges on unstated invocations of precursors, an implied or covert intertextuality. For example, in Abdur Rahim's Gaji Kalu Champavati Konarpunti, the sleeping hero Gaji, who is our peer, is carried into the Brahmin princess Champa's bedroom by curious fairies who wanted to see the beautiful young woman and the handsome young man side by side, that mischief, of course, resulting in their immediate private betrothal. It set the stage for the rest of the plot, which was the quest for reunion after the fairies returned Gaji to his own room. Now, that episode perfectly mirrors that of the allegorical Sufi love story of Manohar and Madhumalati, which in turn mirrors the tale of Kamar al-Zaman in Arabian Nights, thereby instantly signaling an expectation of a type of action, a type of leading character, and so forth, accomplished only by the invocation of the scene and no other explicit reference. Less explicitly, for instance, in the shaping of the Ummah, however loosely defined in these texts, there is an implicit imitatio Muhammadi at work that runs as an undercurrent to whatever concerns might emerge about proper conduct for Muslims. There are numerous examples of these implied precursors, and they often function well beyond the confines of the text themselves. Now, the point here is that the intertextualities situate any text, and in our immediate concerns, situate the narratives of the peers and Bibis in such a way that they become part of a shared discourse among the authors and audiences, in spite of the autotelic nature and ahistorical nature of the text, the narratives themselves. Shared, however, does not automatically signal identical. So though Through a comparison of differences, one can chart at least some subtle shifts in attitude or simply different perspectives that the authors express altogether. So, with that kind of theoretical lens, I want to look at some episodes from the Bonbibi Juhurnama. Bonbibi is the I used to call her the Muslim goddess of the forest, but more than a few people corrected me on that. But I still think it's actually the most accurate. So the matron of the forest. To demonstrate briefly how these features might be useful to understand a particular text, I'll look at some passages from the Bonbibi Juhurnama of Muhammad Khatir, which was composed in the 1880s. He begins, Berahim's wife... This is the personae, so you can keep straight the story. Berahim's wife, Fulbibi, was unable to conceive, so Berahim went to Mecca, where he humbly petitioned Allah for children. Fatima was with the Prophet in heaven and fetched the Quran from its throne. The Prophet checked what was written and saw that Fulbibi was destined to be barren, but that two children, one boy, one girl, would be born in Berahim's house. At the command of Allah, Berahim was to marry Golal Bibi, the daughter of the fakir Shah Jalil. God then determined it was time for the great event of the birth. Allah summoned Bonbibi and Shah Jangali, both of whom were residing in heaven, and issued this command. You will be born to a Bibi named Golal in the home of Berahim. And so they descended, Avatar, with the express mission of confronting Dokin Rai and chastising Donai. Now, because of a promise, Berahim abandoned his second wife, Golal Bibi, in the forest as she was pregnant. She birthed twins, a girl, Bonbibi, and a boy, Shah Jangali, just as God had predicted she would. She abandoned the girl, having made that choice, who was raised by the animals of the forest. She figured she could only handle one child at a time. After some years, Bonbibi did manage somehow to catch up with her brother. She'd been nurtured by all the tigers and deer and so forth in the forest until she was a young lady. And together, Shah Jangali and Bonbibi traveled to Mecca, where they became the students of one of the descendants of Hassan. Now, Hassan is a shorthand for Hussein and Hassan. After studying, they visited the grave of Fatima to ask her blessings, where a disembodied voice directed them to go to the land of the 18 tides, the Atharvati, or the Sundarban. They then visited the tomb of the Prophet, where they praised him as, quote, the guru of all fakirs, and requested his imprimatur in their quest to establish the Khalifa in that swampy place. His sanction came in the form of special hats, which they accepted. They made their obeisance and left. As they reached the edge of the swamplands of the Sundarban, they were warned of a powerful landlord named Dokin Rai, who controlled the fabulous wealth of the place, timber, honey, wax, and salt. When they entered the region and Shah Jangali paused to give the call to prayer, the sound rolled across those low-lying islands like thunder, and Dokin Rai immediately realized it was not the voice of his friend, the peer, Borokhan Gaji, with whom he had made peace after a lengthy battle years earlier. His emissary, Shanatan, reported back that he had espied a young man and a young woman, both dressed in black robes, offering praise to Allah, with hands upraised and their staffs firmly planted in the ground, laying claim to the place in the name of Allah. It sounds sort of like a colonial, you know, effort here. We're going to go colonize. Rai was furious that they had not first approached him for permission to enter. Now, that's not because of a religious act that was involved, but rather it was control of the land and hubris. So he summoned his army of ghouls and prepared to drive them off. But Rai's mother, Narayani, intervened and advised him not to fight a woman. Should he win, there'd be no victory. But should he lose, the humiliation would be permanent. And Rai thought this made a lot of sense, and so Narayani gathered her army, 156,000 goblins, ghouls, and ghosts, and emerged from the cremation grounds as messenger of death, Dal Kaldut, and another 360 million witches were conjured, and literally 360 million. Narayani and her hordes advanced on Bonbibi and Shah Jangali from all sides. The twins were worried, but the elder Bonbibi reassured her younger brother. He was born second. that he need only call on Allah for protection. He again belted out the call to prayer, which rattled the skittish legions, causing them to scatter in all directions. Bone Bibi's own loud roar, her hunkar, paralyzed the rest of the demonic masses, and she rained destruction down upon them. Narayani rallied and let fly her arrows, but Bone Bibi always saw them coming. So with the Kalima wet on her lips, those arrows passed through her body as if she were made of mere water. Narayani unleashed her most fearsome weapons, the Shat Chakra, the Gada Chakra, and finally the ultimate Dharma Chakra. They roared through the air like angry missiles, but again Bone Bibi tasted the Kalima, planted her staff, and the fiery weapons simply fizzled out. Narayani then struck hard at Bone Bibi, but she remained untouched as the gleaming sword turned into harmless flowers by the grace of Fatima. Bone Bibi and Narayani proceeded in hand-to-hand combat for the rest of the day, neither one getting the upper hand, until Bone Bibi felt herself giving way. So she petitioned Khoda, God, for help from heaven, and through an intermediary, he granted her the additional power, in this case Baraka rather than Karamat, that she needed. Bone Bibi mounted and then sat on the chest of Narayani, in an image very much like Kali, squeezing from her the very breath of life until she capitulated. Then Bone Bibi relented. Being the mother of mercy, Bone Bibi graciously accepted Narayani as her vassal, but she did agree to share the rule of the land. Now the next story in that cycle in the Bone Bibi Juharnama is the story of Dhona and Dukke. And it follows the pitiful and helpless child Dukke, who, having been made over to Dokin Rai by his uncle Donai, called on Bone Bibi to intervene and protect him. Shah Jangali was about to battle Dokin Rai and dispatch him to the realm of Yama, is a quotation here, when Borakan Gaji himself intervened and cooled him down. Shah Jangali could not understand how a God-fearing Gaji warrior could be friends with a demon, Rakshasa, like Dokin Rai, sufficient to mediate on his behalf. As they faced off, Bone Bibi's own summons rang insistently in their ears, so the three of them went before her, hands pressed together in supplication. She wanted to know just how it was that this Borokan Gaji, the great peer, could be friends of Dokin Rai. Gaji explained that he was the son of Shah Sikandar, and that he had previously defeated Dokin Rai. As a result, he allowed Rai to share power in the region. Then Borokan reminded Bone Bibi that Dokin Rai was her de facto son because she had defeated his mother, Narayani, in battle and then offered her protection and grace in sharing the land. That made Narayani's offspring Bone Bibi's own. Bone Bibi acknowledged the truth of it, and so a second rapprochement was achieved. Now, these are three tiny snippets from a much longer text, but I think they'll be sufficient to illustrate some of the defining parameters of the discursive arena in which the fictional tale of the Bone Bibi Juharnama operates. The two biggest genre we've talked about before, the pir katha as fictions, and language. We've already explored in previous talks other pragmatic presuppositions, but I want to go over some again. So we can see the way these work as the cosmos is traversed. The cosmos, imagined in these texts, treats the heavens and their multitudes of celestial inhabitants much on the order of Puranic structures. Heaven, or Behesht, is a clearly defined space up there where Allah holds court with Muhammad and Fatima and various assistants, and which is populated by the pious, and where the Quran itself sits on its own throne. The reference to the Quran, an obvious overt intertextual claim, and its use in divining fate mimics a complex of both astrologers and the god Bidatha, who writes one's fate not in a book but on the forehead. Allah is ordering Bone Bibi and Shah Jangali to an earthly birth in order to combat the unholy actions of Dokin Rai, and then Donai clearly invokes the Puranic avatars, and the terminology deployed is exactly the same, avatar. The casting out of Golal Bibi while pregnant with twins recalls the manner of Sita in the Ramayana, a covert intertextual reference. Favoring the son over the daughter signals a Bengali cultural assumption that is common across all religious groups. Access to Allah and his power comes in several distinct forms that parallel other prevailing practices. One can meditate on him while uttering the Kalima, invoking, of course, yogic mantras. One can recite his name in zikr, which is, of course, equivalent to the Vaishnava kirtan, or one can pray at the prophets in Fatima's tombs, which is roughly equivalent to visiting temples. Those mechanisms are expressed in clear hierarchical terms. The symbolic nature of religious relationships often then get translated into kinship terms. But they're only available, this access is only available to the righteous. One is to call on model figures immediately above, as Berahim petitioned Allah directly, as Bonbibi advised Shah Jangali to do when he was in need, but the child Dukke was instructed not to call on Allah, but to call on Bonbibi for help, so a little further down in the hierarchy. In all cases, there is an assumption of supplication, that is, servant to master or supplicant to protector, and kinship, junior to senior, as the model for devotion. The negotiation is through social relationships and public perceptions of stature, not religion per se. Karma, explicitly invoked, is part of the currency of that economy as well. In the end, the cosmology that emerges from the Bonbibi story, as most encompassing, features Allah as the sole god and every other figure below him, with Hindu gods and yogis and the peers and bibis all operating with similar relative forms of power, a very different proposition from that of the earlier texts such as the Rai Mangal, as we shall shortly see. Other features of the imagined cosmos include the emergence of a number of more or less malevolent figures common to Hinduani classifications. Now, for those of you who haven't been here before, Hinduani and Musalmani refer to the pre-19th century social orientation of Bengal, whereas in the 19th century it shifts where religious identity becomes political identity and it becomes Hindu and Muslim. So when I use Hindu and Muslim, I'm talking about post-mid-19th century. So here we see a Musalmani appropriation of a Hinduani cosmos. All of them, Bhuts, Prates, Joganis, Dakinis, etc., all of these lower figures will be ranked lower than the morally upright humans. And in this text, they constitute the minions of Dokin Rai and Narayani, a not-so-subtle signal of an adjusted place in this new cosmos. So, there was references to Bordokan Gaji, who I have to admit is my favorite of all the characters. At a critical moment, Bonbibi asks how Ajabon, Bordokan Gaji, who is in another text identified as a Turk, could be friends with the Hinduani Zamindar. The adventures of Dokin Rai and Bordokan Gaji predate the Bonbibi Juhurnama by several centuries, but their appearance in Bonbibi's story and her reference to their conflict established two types of intertextuality: overt with respect to the tales and analeptic with respect to the characters. Their prior interaction provides not only a backdrop of her story, but the ensuing relationship explicitly conditions the outcome of her own conflict with Narayani, Dokin Rai's mother, as the narrator has openly declared. The earliest extant version of the conflict between Dokin Rai and Bordokan Gaji is the Rai Mangal of Krishnaram, which dates to the late decades of the 17th century. There is a text by one Madhavacharya, which is supposed to be a few years earlier, but we only have fragments. There is another complete text a couple of decades later, which is a radically different form of text and almost a kind of Bengali Purana. So this is really the primary source for the original Dokin Rai story, as far as we can tell. The conflict, it was composed in 1684. The conflict was the result of an insult born of ignorance by a merchant named Dhanpati who was heading south to trade. As he was going through the Shundarban, the unwitting trader failed to pay any, much less commensurate, respect to Bordokan Gaji, a prominent warrior saint who lived in the forest with his band of tigers. So he worshipped Dokin Rai publicly, but failed to worship Bordokan Gaji. The Gaji was humiliated, as were all of his tigers and fakirs, and as a result, he became inconsolably angry. So he sought revenge on both the merchant and on Dokin Rai, who had stood back and allowed this to transpire without intervention. Bordokan Gaji's fakir followers and tigers share in this humiliation. And this is from the Rai Mongol. This is a direct translation, which I'm hoping Imre will help me with, since there are passages in here that have a kind of proto-Hindustani pigeon Hindustani. So, in the presence of all gathered there, Gaji cursed the merchant. "This sister fucker's fled. Now what are you going to do? The bastard will be totally lost. Can't you just hear Dokin Rai wail when he's bound and hauled back here? Only then shall I again be considered a true warrior saint, a Gaji." Thus Khan instructed them to crush the ears of Rai's servants. "I have to see for myself just what kind of shaitan he is. Every day his bare fists pummel people into bloody submission. He seizes their land and produces with a flourish a document that testifies to his ownership, that claims it as his property." And they sped off to destroy Dokin Rai. But they only managed to sack his dwellings and image. They couldn't find him. And the text goes on, "Someone laid hold the Brahmin priest, ripping off his sacred thread. They jostled him to the ground and with a swarm of fists battered him senseless. This army of fakirs deliberately polluted his food. Your jati, like your body, is stripped, and now all you can wear is a beard, you daughter fucker." By the way, this text is laden with more obscenities than any Bengali text I have ever read, by a factor of about 100. I mean, it really is racy language. One of Dokin Rai's senior tigers, an experienced diplomat, attempted to broker a truce, but to no avail. The conflict, now inevitable, materialized quickly. Rai gathered all of his tigers and set out to destroy Bordokan. And I quote here, "When suddenly the two leaders appeared, they began to heap abuse on one another. Rai was first to scream insults at Gaji. 'Previously, you fell at my feet. Do you not remember that? But when you started to eat meat, you became high and mighty. So who is that chum to you now? You snatched away the mercenary Brahmin's whore daughter, and that act makes you little more than a common highwayman.'" And I have very selectively eliminated about 20 epithets in the next six lines. "What kind of infidel are you, you lowlife?" You lowlife bastard, I guess. "Listen carefully to my pronouncements, you dunce, you filthy vulture. What do you do here in the jungly wild besides smoke your hookah and get intoxicated? Are you really such an ignoramus that you spew deprecations from your pumpkin chariot?" Does anybody know what the pumpkin chariot is? It's the bowl of the hookah. "All of the prosperity you previously enjoyed as a result of your various offices will disappear like so much wet smoke belching from your water pipe. Are you listening, whoremonger, to this rehearsal of your death? My lord, Goshai is the essential reality of all manner of creation, you sister fucker." wouldn't you love to be involved in a religious conversation like this? "After many vile imprecations, they exchanged blows. Dokin Rai slew Gaji's tigers, and the others immediately abandoned him. As he fervently meditated on the prophet Paigambard, doom seemed to fall right when Gaji's chest split open. His body slumped to the ground, lifeless, but his prayer to Paigambard, that is the prophet, had been rewarded, and he healed himself with a new body, the old one still lying on the ground. Shiva's trident had proved ineffective for Dokin Rai." Dokin Rai is actually the offspring of Shiva. "Unknown to Rai, the Paigambar had bestowed on Gaji the power to strike a blow that never failed. For Yama, the lord of death himself, dwelled in the sword's diamond-sharp edge. After using magical incantations to round up and slay all of Rai's tigers, he advanced toward his foe and with a calculated deliberation raised his sword so that all could witness as he severed Rai's head from his body. It fell to the ground with a deafening thud and rolled still in the dirt. The earth herself staggered and tilted under the weight, and the gods were startled. Suddenly," and this is a direct quotation, "the Supreme Lord himself, Ishvara, personally appeared to mediate and end the dispute." And here's what he said, or how it's reported. Half of his head was black, a tuft of hair pulled to one side, a wildflower garland and rosary looping his forearms. Half of the body was a dazzling white, the other half the deep indigo of rain clouds, the Quran in one hand and Puran, that is Bhagavad Puran, in the other. The exact same vision was beheld by both men, and both fell and grasped his feet. That Lord of the universe lifted them up, placed one's hand in the other, and made them to understand they must establish a formal pact of friendship. Borakan, you and Rai are one and the same. In this matter, only knuckle-headed barbarians see you as different and suffer all manner of misery for it. Borakan's magically created body will from its grave emanate a charismatic power, Keramat, that will allow people to gain their desires. Wherever the name of the peer is invoked, that locale is designated an official court where any decree or settlement can be registered in his name. And then it goes on from there. Now, the resulting stalemate effectively granted formal, that is, mogul-recognized, land rights to Dokhin Rai. Remember, he's waving that paper saying, these lands belong to me. That was a shift from the Sultanate to the Mughal period. That was a shift in administrative measures, where the granting of land with the paper documents started taking place. But Borakan exercised a plenipotentiary power over the entire region. So Dokhin Rai gets to rule, but actually Borakan has no limits, a considerably stronger position. Now, turns out there's another cycle of Borakan Gaji stories called Gaji Kalu O Champavati. And there, it's a different version of the story, and the tale, the one that I'm going to talk about is called Gaji Kalu O Champavati Konar Punti, the first one of which was composed by Sheikh Kota Baksh in the first half of the 18th century. In this tale, and there are several others, I'm actually taking from this one right here, which follows this one, which follows that one. In this tale, Gaji leaves home with his brother Kalu to become a wandering fakir. He moves around Bengal helping various groups, such as woodcutters, prostitutes, Brahmins, and so forth. And then, as we noted above, is carried by fairies to the bedroom of the Brahmin princess Champavati, only to be removed at daybreak back to his original lodging, but on her bed, proof of his experience. Gaji then seeks her, finds her in the city of Brahmanagar, her father, the Brahmin king Mukut Raja. There is, by the way, a historical Mukut Raja. So a lot of people try to make that connection, who is horrified that she's fallen in love with Gaji, the liaison guaranteed to destroy his social standing. Mukut Raja's zamindar and safety guarantor is Dokhin Rai, a giant of a demigod. Eventually, Borakan Gaji and Dokhin Rai will fight. Borakan Gaji has thousands of tigers, which scare the invincible warrior Dokhin Rai, so the latter summons the goddess Chondi, and as her devoted servant asks for an army of crocodiles, about 300,000, give or take. But after days of battle, Gaji beckons the sun to blaze hotter than hell itself, and the crocodiles start to make for the water, because, you know, they have no pores, so they can't sweat, when they are finally destroyed in their weakened condition by the tigers. So Dokhin Rai goes back to Chondi, this time for ghouls and goblins, boots, prates, so forth, Dakinis, Joginis. She reluctantly provides them, but warns him that he will never defeat Borakan Gaji, because Borakan Gaji is her nephew. It's the son of her sister, Ajupa. And more importantly, Borakan Gaji is favored by both Ishvara and Koda. But Dokhin Rai, who knows he can't win, wishes to avoid humiliation. It's the public humiliation that drives him. Needless to say, Rai's minions flee. Gaji subdues him and cuts off his ears. He relents, though, before cutting his throat, and Dokhin Rai promises to make the king hand over his daughter to Borakan Gaji as desired. The king, however, isn't going to cooperate, so he musters his own army, explicitly 30,700,000 men, marches them out, and promptly loses all of them. That night, however, he takes water from a magic well, sprinkles it over them, and they pop up ready to fight again. This goes on for 18 days, conveniently the same length of the Mahabharata Wars, until the tigers are weary. Finally, Gaji realizes the secret, throws a dead cow into the well, and thereby rendering it ineffective, so the men cannot be revived, and it's over. Champavati is then given to Gaji, who marries her, and after a while, he, she, and Gaji's brother Kalu take up their mendicant ways and depart the city. Dokin Rai becomes the public servant of the Gaji, but the latter allows him to have dominion over the western side of the Sundarban, while he exerts his plenipotentiary control over the whole. Today, most Hindus are on the western side, and Muslims are on the east. Now, with these sets of stories, if we return to the Bon Bibi Juhar Nama, that narrative revalorizes the powerful Dokin Rai into a more menacing religious enemy, that is, a Hindu in the post-1850 sense, a shapeshifter who can assume the form of a tiger to terrorize and eat humans, completely counter to the previous narrative's images of him. Normally, he rides a horse or a tiger. So in answer to the simple question, how did the Jabon Borokhan and the Jamindar Dokin Rai broker a peace and share power, the Bon Bibi tale politicizes the figures in terms reflective of the emergence of religious identities as political identities. That simpler narrative disentangles a considerably more ambiguous earlier narrative, using many of the same characters, the same settings, and resolved according to the same available economies of power, but displaced by a generation. Among the analeptic figures in Bon Bibi's story, we find Shah Sikandar, who rules over Boirat. Shah Sikandar is the father of Borokhan Gaji. And there is a historical figure named Shah Sikandar. And of course, Muhammad and Fatima in the Bon Bibi narrative provide another set. Fatima and Muhammad are both very much alive and active in heaven, with their powers accessible through their tombs. But the worship of the tomb is not affected until both twins have achieved their credentials as spiritual masters by studying with the descendant in the line of Ali. The obvious Shia connection, again, is overt to intertextual reference, that gives them the right to petition Fatima at her grave. As promised in the Rai Mungal, the grave is a source of power and purity, and it functions as the real court of God. Here, Fatima's tomb acts as a direct pipeline to the possibility of divine interventions. This, by the way, is common in a lot of these tales, where the tomb is the court of God, is Behisht. That grace of Fatima later aids Bon Bibi by protecting her from Narayani's sword and giving her the power to evade the terrible weapons hurled by Narayani, notably weapons found explicitly in the epics. Fatima's tomb lies in the same compound as that of Muhammad, and again, the connection to God in his heavenly court, Behisht, is immediate and direct. And the twins, now themselves murshids, teachers, can approach Muhammad directly as the guru of all fakirs, the real heavyweight, as the term guru means, among teachers, that is, the teacher's teacher, whose actions inspire the imitatio Muhammadi. It's significant that no other tomb worship was mentioned. In the historical context of the 1880s, when the Bon Bibi story was first composed, tomb worship was a very hot topic, and one has to wonder if the character's actions seem to hint at some middle position on the availability of power through the tomb. Not just any tomb, mind you, but only that of special members of the family of Muhammad al-Bayt. Or, in the case of Borokhan Gaji, a Jinda peer. An extraordinary peer, Zinda peer. And at this point, we start to slip into the world of the text's pragmatics. That is, we're shifting now discourse. How the texts affect real Bengalis in real life. The subject of the final chapter of my monograph, this, what I've been talking about, is the penultimate chapter. So in this brief exercise, we can see that the four parameters that define the discursive arena of the Bon Bibi Juhar Nama helped us to situate the text in its historical place, with its literary and religious interlocutors. Yet, in our extremely truncated exercise, by identifying the text's presuppositions and intertextual connections, we can spot significant shifts in the way an author parodies tensions how he traffics in stereotypes rather than doctrine. What began in the earlier texts, explicitly invoked as recognition of equivalence between Dokhin Rai and Bodhakan Gaji, or in religious terms, a Hinduani cosmological structure stretching to recognize and accept Mushalmani notions of divinity mediated through kinship models, the Bon Bibi story reorients those same characters by displacing their previous action onto a new field, wherein a Mushalmani cosmology expands to accommodate and appropriate a more generalized Bengali cosmos. But the reordering is cast in significantly different terms that seem to signal the transformation of a Bengali culture composed of people with Hinduani and Mushalmani clan networks to a new order wherein Muslims and Hindus are cast in political terms in conflict, the legacy of the 19th century. Thanks.